when we try to bring peace into our lives, when we try to become calm, when we close our eyes during meditation, or when we try to relax, the Buddha said that the mind is like it's like a little community. It's like some monks talk about it like a mob. Ajahn Jeff and Ajahn Susita use the word a little neighborhood. There's all these casts of characters inside. Some of them are actually skillful. Whether they're there when we're born or not is up to debate. Could be that we've seen skillful people in our lives and internalized them, but there's certainly in the mind a desire for calmness and peace, samadhi. There's a desire there to be useful, to be helpful to others, kagga. There's a desire to be people of perhaps integrity, to feel good about our actions, which is sila. And there's appreciation, mudita, and there's other factors that can be in there. Maybe perhaps diligence or persistence, viriya. But also very often there is a cast of characters in the block inside of our brain that are not quite as easy to deal with. And these are what the Buddha called nivaranas. These are the we often are translate as the hindrances to peace in our minds. The things that keep us stirred up. Wait until that. So, there are, according to the Buddha, there are five characters that we're going to come across, even more than five, but he came up with a very useful list of five, and five is about the maximum that I can remember of any given list, and I start to get a little fuzzy. Seven I can do, but eight, but five is the easiest amount. I like lists of five. So, the first character is what was in Pali known as Kamachanda, which means I want, the I want guy, or girl, whatever. He doesn't necessarily have a gender, but it's that voice in our head that really, really wants something. It could be like approval. It could be people liking us. It could be pleasurable sensations. It could be we're trying to get something to make us feel good. And of course, generally when we get it, we feel good for about 2 minutes, and then we realize that the lack of feeling good is inside of us, so we don't realize it, and that we just look around for something else. It's that, what were we saying? Buyer's remorse. When you buy that new iPad, and for about 3 minutes during opening the box, life feels complete. Then you actually have it, you turn it on, and there's this feeling in the body and in the mind of, oh, it really hasn't fixed anything. Relationships last longer. You can get, the mind is set up to make relationships, new relationships, more pleasurable for longer. We get a couple maybe of good weeks, maybe a couple of good months. Then you start feeling the inner stress and the fact that you haven't been magically fixed. And then we think, there's something wrong with that person. Got to find somebody new. So that's Kamachanda, that constantly looking out there for something to make us feel good, something like approval, a sense of fame, a sense of having a lot, a sense of wealth, a sense of approval, all that stuff. That's what we're searching for. The second is Vyapada, which is the exact opposite. It's wanting to get rid of something. If only I could get rid of that roommate, that boss, etc. If only I could get rid of this job. If only I could get rid of... And then, of course, whenever you get rid of that thing, then you have the same amount of pleasure that you got from getting something, and then you're back in stress again. Why? Because these are external things. They're not in here. They're out there. So you can't fix what's inside with things that are out there. They're just distractions to dealing with core internal emotional, you know, issues. The third, what was the third? The restlessness is Udaka. Udaka is that sense of there's so many things to do. I can't settle down. I can't relax. I can't be peaceful. I got a lot of shit to do. And of course, whenever you ask this voice in the mind, well, what's the most important thing? It never knows. It's just there's so much to do. Fuck it. I can't list one thing. It's just I'm overwhelmed. There's just, and then if you really say, well, you know, well, what's the most important thing for me to do right now? It's often just like, do the taxes. No. I got to get a better job. No. I got to deal with, you know, it doesn't. It's always got one other thing to focus on. That sense that we're not doing enough. It's called restlessness and anxiety. And then there was... laziness, which is tinamida, which simply means that, oh, it's all too much. I can't deal. I wish I could smoke pot and not get paranoid and just watch TV all day and or just sleep or just, you know, if only I could take Xanax socially. If only I just didn't have to deal with all this shit. What, can't it all just go away? You know, that desire for obliteration, vibhana, that desire to just go into some numbed out state. And then finally, there is extreme cynicism and suspicion, and why am I doing this anyway? It only works for hippies. It's a well-known fact. Real people don't meditate. Real people drink bourbon and I don't know what they do. I'm the last person to ask what real people do, but they do something other than this meditation shit and this, you know, this staying calm and this, like, working with the breath and relaxing the body sensations and try to observe what's going on. That's ridiculous. Everybody knows that the way to deal with things is to do things. You don't just sit there. It's crap. So, those are the five characters. Again, we've got I want, I don't want, restlessness and busyness, extremely just want it all to go away, and then that extreme cynicism and suspicion that it's all a ruse. You know, Josh hasn't asked me for my credit card number yet, but he's gonna one of these days. So, all of these Nivaranas have a couple of things in common. One, they are what's known as also asavas. They keep the mind flowing out into the world looking for the big solution out there. You know? It keeps us, like, except with maybe, like, the laziness and sleepful one, the rest of it is keeping us just moving outwards, looking for something to focus on out there that we feel will fill us up and make everything okay in here. They are also what's known as anusayas. They are habitually ingrained. they become harder and harder and harder because they're also what's known as survival tools. All of these things often help us navigate through difficult times early on because they work very well often in the short term. For instance, I don't like an avoidance. I just want to get away from this person or get away from this situation. Often works as a way to deal with uncomfortable situations when we're children or when we're, or throwing tantrums and demanding that we get something often makes us feel empowered when we're young. Or perhaps the sense of restlessness makes us feel that we're prepared or that we're not slouching, or a sense of deep skepticism and suspicion, of course, can make us feel like we won't be caught off guard. So they're all, in essence, survival tools. They're just used to such an unnecessarily consistent degree by the mind that we don't see that they don't really work beyond the short term. And in the long term, they're not very good tools for finding lasting happiness and peace. They're nowhere near as effective as the tools that we've talked about earlier, like developing calmness, developing generosity, developing compassion, developing wisdom, seeing how our own actions cause our suffering rather than not having shit. That's not the thing that's really causing our suffering. It's our actions. It's the way we use our mind. It's our thoughts. So there are solutions, but these Nivaranas keep us looking outside, out there, and they are basically also what the Buddha called kriya. They are restless, agitational things that move around and get our attention. Like when we're walking in the block in our mind during a meditation, sure, there's the wise characters in there, but they don't tend to shout at us. They don't tend to scream, "Hey, you! Let's relax." They'll be shouting, "Hey, you, what the fuck are you doing? You're just sitting there. Damn it, there's so many things that I should be doing. What are you doing? You're doing nothing. You're just sitting there, you asshole." So these Nivaranas, they make a lot of noise. They move around a lot. They're very agitated. They're very concerned because they really believe they're in our best interests. They really think, oh, we can't settle down, relax, be calm, work on what's going on inside of us. We can't focus on the breath. There's too much important shit that might get out of our grasp out there. So they're very, very constantly moving, and they want our attention. Now, there are a couple of ways that most people, when we start our spiritual practice, try to deal with these unskillful little characters in the mind, in our block. A couple of ways that don't work. Here are the ways that don't work first, before I tell you the ways that do. If I just went to the ways that do, you wouldn't care about the ways that don't work. So I gotta work up to that. So, first way that doesn't work is to try to be, as Ajahn Sasita says, the super cop, the inner tyrant. Okay, we're going to be peaceful now, goddammit. Just try to make a move. The body wants to move. Fuck you! The thought comes up, fuck you! I'm going to zap you with my mind internal laser gun. I'm going to shoot you from the sky. I am super tyrant. And of course, what happens with old tyrants is for a little while, there's a little bit of fear going on in there, and then eventually, though, there's a rebellion. They have an internal rebellion, where eventually all the creatures come out and they start a march in the square, screaming and demanding that we pay attention to what's going on out there in the world. And all of the tyrannical, no, we're going to meditate now. We're going to be a good meditator. It doesn't work. And believe me, it's been tried. By me. And it doesn't, It doesn't work. It's been tried by everybody. The first thing we all do is we try to get frustrated and angry and upset when the mind doesn't settle down. And the problem with it is that the anger and frustration and upset is agitation in and of itself. So we're greeting agitation with more agitation. It's not going to settle anything. It's not going to make you peaceful. It's like, combating hatred with hatred. Doesn't work. So, the other approach that doesn't work, and it's used for a lot longer by people, and even some teachers occasionally think these are good ideas and they don't work. This is dismissive talking down reasoning with these internal voices. For instance, it's a very sanctimonious approach, where when we settle down, we try to meditate, and up comes this voice that says, but there's so many things to do. Then we say to that voice, oh yeah? Really? Name one. What's so important? Or if we're frightened or we're worried, we say, oh really? What's so frightening about what's going on, huh? There's nothing frightening happening. We sort of try to shame the voices away. We think that it's very skillful, or it might be if we're angry, or if we're, we're angry, we're like, oh, there's nothing to be angry about. So it's this kind of like dismissive thing. Oh, you're just a little unskillful voice in me. I'm not going to deal with you. And that will make you go away. Well, guess what? They generally don't go away either. And then we go back to method number one, where we get really frustrated and try to beat them up, because they didn't listen to what we thought was our reasoning. So we're going to go back to, like, just frustrated anger and, like, just go away. I really want to be calm now, and all I'm hearing about is this obsession about somebody who doesn't want to date me or dump me or boss or whatever, and I don't want to think about them. Get the fuck away. I'm meditating now. So, now we get to the ways that do work. The first way that I've found is, rather than dismiss them or try to push them away or beat them up, is to be reassuring. To actually tell these little characters that we're going to give them what they want. We're just going to give it to them in a different way. For example, when I'm really, really worried about something, I tell myself, you know what? If I relax right now and stay calm, I will be so much more effective and so much more able to deal with anything that arises out of the blue than if I sat here and worried about it. Because when I worry, I generally get all just, completely shrunken and agitated, and all I can think of is one solution. But when I'm rested and relaxed, I found that I can actually think of a lot of different solutions to the problems that arise in life. So I remind my fear that, you know what? I'm actually more effective if I'm calmer, if I'm more settled. There are more choices I'll have. The same with my feeling of restlessness, and there's so much to do. Why am I meditating? I tell that voice, you know what? I will get everything done that I need to get done, but I'm going to get it done more efficiently if I'm rested and relaxed and peaceful than if I'm all worked up and bent out of shape. And if you don't believe me, let's try just this once. And I found that, like, even when I'm at work and there's a huge to-do list of things, I will still go out and take a lunch away from my desk, and I will sit there and breathe and relax and be mindful of eating, because when I come back, I've found that I work much more efficiently. Or if I've got that feeling of there's something missing in my life and I gotta have it, I gotta have that iPad, I really gotta have that iPad. I actually have an iPad, so I don't need one, but if I really needed one, whatever it is, whenever I have those cravings that I really have to have something, I often, when I'm meditating, and I say, you know what, I'm not going to completely put that aside and give up on it, But I guarantee you that if we meditate, we will have something that's so much rarer than an iPad in this world. Because inner peace is really the most precious commodity that so few people have. So I'm going to give myself something that even fewer people have than an iPad. And when, you know, doubt comes up, what's the whole point? Or, you know, suspicion. I say, you know what? Be suspicious. That's all right. That's totally okay. But let's just see what happens if we do this for a little while. And we can keep all the suspicion, but let's just give it our all for a little while. And if you're right, I'll completely agree with you. So I don't push any of these inner distractions away. I don't. If I have a little, you know, a need for approval, you know, or a sense of self-importance, and that comes up, and why are you just meditating? Why aren't you out there doing things in the world? I say, you know what? I'll be more effective if I meditate. So all that kind of reassurance I found makes those voices or those characters settle for a lot longer. Now, another technique that works is Ajahn Sisito says that if you get a good rhythm going, instead of trying to beat up these inner characters, if you get a good rhythm going, like if you go into the middle of a town and you start banging a bongo, which would be really irritating to me, but he used that example, so you start like a nice rhythm, then the other characters in the mind, they start to play along with it. This is obviously a metaphor for the breath. Just if you get a calm in-breath and out-breath, a relaxed state in the breath, if you can really get that rhythm going in a really calm way, those voices, you can open your experience and say, come out. But all I'm asking is for you not to take me away from this breath. You can come out all you want, but just allow me to stay with this rhythm. Now, it's a really important technique because all of these characters, these worries, cravings, restlessness, these fears, this underlying sense of radical not trusting anything in the world or in our lives or any spiritual practice, all of these characters, they really want to, when they really get a lot of energy going, they want to grab us and pull us into a dark room and show us a movie about how bad it's all going to be unless we listen to them. It's the internal multimedia show. Psychologists call it dissociation, where we basically no longer become aware of our environments. We become lost in a cloud of these horrible thoughts or these fantasies about, oh, if only I had that one thing. And we're no longer aware of anything that's going on. We no longer have any awareness of the body, the breath. We're no longer, the mind is totally contracted and we're in that multimedia presentation. So the breath is one of the great tools that allows us not to be sucked in. It keeps us outdoors. It doesn't allow us to be sucked into that little dark chamber with that voice, that inner character. Another tool that's really helpful, and Ajahn Sisito spoke a lot about it this weekend, and I really like it a lot, is in our body awareness, when we're feeling the body, to try to make your sense of the body as expansive and large and widened as you can. Because the more you make the feeling of yourself as large as you can, the smaller these disturbances in the mind will feel. If you've got awareness of your entire body when fear comes up, it's going to be a very small sound. But if the mind's very small, well, then fear is going to be very large. It's going to take over all of your awareness. It's like a black hole that's going to suck you in. So we don't want to get too close to that black hole and get sucked into that dark multimedia presentation. to use as many metaphors as I can in one sentence. We want to stay away from it. You don't get too close to a black hole. The gravity will, now I'm sounding like a science nerd, but whatever, will suck you in. But if you want to observe it, you keep the sense of the body as much as possible in your awareness. He actually talked this weekend about how there's this emotional body, which is this small, compact thing where we experience ourselves, which generally gets smaller and smaller and smaller the more abused and mistreated and stressed out we feel in life. We become the shrunken little pea that sits behind the eyes. And that's the entirety of the way we experience our bodies. And when we are this small, little, tiny experiential pea, then when anger comes up, it's going to take over because we're this small. But if we are as wide and as large as we can be, then when anger or fear or craving arises, it will feel much smaller. So keeping the rhythm of the breath, reassuring these voices will give them what they want, just in a different way. And keeping the body as expansive as it can. Two more small little tools and then we'll be done. During meditation, and this is the only time to really practice this, is to focus the mind not on the areas or the characters that create a lot of noise and repeat themselves a lot, papancha, that create a lot of a song and dance show, hey, listen to me, hey, listen to me. But to actually find those parts of your experience that are calmer and refocus your attention to them. Reward them for being calmer. Reward the internal voices that don't insult you, that don't say, hey, shithead, what are you doing now? But instead say, oh, this is great. Or, oh, we're trying something else. Or maybe when I'm done with this, I should call and check in with a friend or whatever. Those voices that are calmer, that don't repeat themselves, that aren't insulting, give them attention. Stay with them. It's really, really helpful. The thing about these distractions is that generally we're so preoccupied with the world, we don't notice how loud they are in the mind. They're always there. There's always craving, and there's always going to be fear, and there's always going to be those little voices singing and dancing. But because we're so distracted by the world, we're not aware of just how much is going on in our minds. But then when we try to settle down and bring our awareness within, there they are. It's not like they come out from under rocks when you close your eyes. It's just that you're no longer distracted by the world and suddenly you're aware of just how much agitation there is in the mind. So this is the time during meditation where we can focus on empowering the more quiet parts of our internal landscape. For instance, empowering the part of the mind that wants to be calm, that wants to be present, that wants to be generous, that wants to appreciate rather than crave, that wants to feel gratitude, that wants to, all those things that don't keep us flowing outwards, but instead allow us to settle inside. Finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that one of the most important tools to learn how to deal and cope with our relationships with our minds is to hang around or associate, as they say and teachers call it, associate, I use hang around, but associate with other people that are calm and collected and not as drama queeny as we generally tend. It's understandable that the most dramatic, loud people that are constantly in these uproarious narratives and these crazy situations are fun to be with because it's sort of amusing and it's distracting. Whereas the people who have attained calm and are, you know, happy and are not especially prone to getting into any outlandish dramas in life, they're kind of boring, you know? I mean, it's nice, but they don't have all this crazy shit that my other friend has got going on. The only problem is that the more we focus on craziness out there in the world, the more we're likely to focus on those outlandish, completely dramatic, completely fraught with misery or whatever that's in the mind. And the more we can focus and be with things and people and situations that are calmer and quieter in our external experience, the more we will be able to focus on those when we try to develop bhavana, or inner peace. So those are five strategies for working with the mind, and we'll be giving you many, many more as the weeks go on, because the Buddha was not short on tools to deal with stress and suffering. So, but that's it for tonight, so I hope you got something, and now's your turn to ask any questions or share anything that's going on, and I thank you for attending. Hi.
If I don't have craziness in my life, then I'm watching NIPCO all the time. You know what, I don't know how. I was like listening to you say that, and I don't know how I'm going to live a life without drama and craziness. That scares me. I noticed that around people who are really calm, I feel aversion.
Mm.
And I feel like disgusted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe that's because, like, there's, like, parts of me that are rejecting that new, like, you know? But, just like you, if you could touch on. Well, I mean, I know, like, I should, like, if I'm feeling that, I should, like, breathe. There's, like, a solution. I can, like, breathe and, like, ask about the kindness for me and this person that I find annoying and disgusting. And then, you know, I can maybe, like, meditate about it later. But, yeah, like, how do people, you know, like, how would someone come from being, like, having a crazy life to trying to live a life of mindfulness?
I mean, it's a great question, and I'll say, first of all, this is just about rebalancing. It's not about casting aside all your dramatic friends and just hanging around with renunciate monks, right? I mean, the idea, though, is because we tend to be so drawn to people that are just constantly, you know, fraught. And we're so often just uninterested in balancing with also having wise people that are calm, that it's about having both. Now, I guarantee you, because I hang around with a lot of monks, these guys are fascinating. They paint. They do all sorts of creative things. They travel all over the world. They deal with some of the most nutty people, because if you go to a retreat, my God, I would less said the better, but people go on retreats because they really need to go on retreat. And they're really, really calm. They're like really, really interesting, fascinating, wonderful, funny people. They always have amazing senses of humor. You know, so it's not like you're talking about somebody who's utterly emotionless or just, you know, just this boring thing. But at first, yeah, when we're earlier in our lives and we're in situations where there's maybe lots of alcohol and drugs and drama and stuff like that, we naturally go to that. We're drawn to that because it's where the mind most naturally likes to settle on. And we're most naturally programmed to go to the people who've got the most movement and craziness and insanity. And we're not programmed to go to people that are calm and generous and content and happy and are trying to be, you know, to live very guided, purposeful, stable lives. Once we go to them, we'll find that they're every bit as fascinating and have every bit as much to offer. Then it's no longer, you know, we're not trying to get rid of anyone. We're just trying to refocus the mind to the places that the mind doesn't want to go. The mind doesn't like to go to peace. It doesn't like to go to generosity, contentment, people who are, you know, like that. So it's a practice. And it's one that's, the more you see what the long-term results of having these people in your life, like, the more I hang out with monks, afterwards, it's just a sense of calmness and the sense of guidedness and the sense of reassurance that I'm on the right path that I get nowhere else. And it's so rewarding. And I get a lot of joy from being, you know, around a lot of insane people that are recovering from drugs and alcohol who are totally nuts. That's fun too. But I'm not just focusing on them. I'm also focusing on developing both. And it's a practice. And it takes years. And is it possible if you have a nutty, dramatic childhood? Of course. Because you hear the stories of a lot of these people that have become monks, and they have some of the hairiest stories before they became, you know, and a lot of people I've met in Buddhist practice over the decades have had some of the most abusive and weird and crazy, and left home when they were way too young and got into all sorts of crazy situations, and they all have been able to find peace. So it's not a matter of having any magical powers or us being or needing to have something that we don't have. It's just a matter of practice. It's a matter of stretching what we're usually used to habitually doing and making an effort to focus not only on, you know, the fun, dramatic people, but also focus on reaching out to people that seem to have acquired some inner peace. So we're balancing our lives, just like we're balancing our awareness between what's going on inside with what's going on outside. We're balancing the fun drama queens with the fun, maybe less fun, but still fun, you know, wise people. I hope that makes some sense. Hi.
A lot of the time we talk about, especially when there's like a negative emotion, like grief or something, rather than sort of experiencing aversion towards that, sort of sitting with it, seeing it arise and fall, and sort of saying, oh, this is grief, you know, this is what it feels like, this is the Dhamma.
Right.
Is that kind of experience, is that also relevant in talking about what you're describing, the hindrances? For instance, a sense of agitation or a sense of living to say, this is, I mean, I don't know, this is something standing in my way, I'm sort of sitting there for a while.
Yeah, exactly. I should have made it clear that in the point of making the body feel as large as we can is so that we can, when these when doubt or suspicion or anger or greed or lust or whatever wants to drag us away from being peaceful right now arises, we can practice yoniso manasikara, which means appropriate attention, which means we can watch it. We can see, oh, okay, like, how does this affect my body when anger arises? Rather than just fall into the story, which we normally do, we can become aware of what's happening. It's interesting, when I was riding my bike over the bridge, there was somebody who was in my lane, and I wasn't really paying attention because I was in my lane and I didn't see anybody in front of me, and suddenly he darted in my lane, in the oncoming lane for him, and then he screamed at me, and I became awake, and I veered out of his way because he was passing somebody. He wanted to go into my lane, into the oncoming lane. So for a moment I felt like, well, why the fuck did he scream at me? Why didn't he just wait until I passed before he tried to pass that other biker? But then I thought, you know, rather than fall into the story, why don't I just see what this anger is doing to me while I was on my bike? And I felt my stomach had gotten contracted. And the moment I released it and made my body feel more expansive, then I could allow that anger story and those feelings to rise, but I was no longer sucked in. And then I could see, okay, this is what it feels like. This is how it takes over me. It takes over me first by sucking my stomach in, making my shoulders go up, becoming unaware of what's going on, you know, in other senses, shrinking my mind and going into a story. That's the way anger works. And then eventually with yoniso manasikara, then we can see, okay, well, how do we get out of it? You know? And the way for me with anger is body awareness, relaxing the stomach, then relaxing my shoulders, relaxing my jaw, then finding the breath again, then expanding the mind, and eventually reassuring the anger, well, you know what? That guy's going to live in a shitty life for a while because he's screaming at people that he has no right to scream at, so whatever. I don't have to do anything to him. I don't have to think about him because he's got to live in a mind that is that impatient, you know, whatever. So I hope that makes some sense. Hi, all the way in the back.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for your...